Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Safe. I know I should always advise you to go and subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Castro, all these places that feature, the podcast. And by the way, our guest today has also recently launched her own podcast, our contributor, Mona Charon. So good to have you back, Mona. I'm sorry.
I'm so glad to be here on the flagship Bulwark Podcast. Thanks for having me.
So your podcast is Beg to Differ. It's a very different format than this podcast, which is filled with snark and cheap shots. Your podcast is erudite and characterized by deep thoughts and intelligent exchanges.
Well,
so
that's very kind of you to say. If it's sort of true, bookends. it's because of my colleagues, Damon Linker of The Week, Bill Galston of Brookings and The Wall Street Journal, and Linda Chavez of Niskanen. These are some really thoughtful, careful writers and thinkers, and we like to joke that we offer, but it's not a joke. We offer political commentary from the center right to the center left, and we think that's the healthiest place to be in American politics. And we lament that there is so much extremism. So if you want to hear from thoughtful people who cluster around the center but take different views on important questions, that's where we are.
Interesting that you're talking about the center right to center left, because that in fact is the part of the electorate that's going to determine the 2020 elections. I mean, I think there was kind of this reality check when that New York Times Siena poll came out earlier this week saying, this election is not going to be decided by who wins the faculty lounge vote at Berkeley. It doesn't matter whether the Democrat runs up in 90% of the vote in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's going to be decided by these persuadable voters in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, et cetera. And those voters tend to be very pragmatic and very centrist.
So this has been a theme of a lot of critics over the last several months, who have noted the strength of Warren and Sanders in the Democratic race and have been warning that if the Democratic Party goes far left, they could easily lose to Donald Trump. And some of the people who are called Never Trumpers have been making this case, and they've been met with a lot of hostility among lefties and liberals, progressives. Right. I'm sure you've experienced it yourself, where they say, you can't tell us who to nominate. You're a Republican. You're in charge. You created this mess. And
the drill,
the whole drill. And so the question still remains, so this New York Times poll was very illuminating, as you say. And there has been more pushback. I mean, certain of the Democratic candidates seem to have recognized that there is an opening in that moderate lane, especially as Joe Biden seems a little shaky as the front runner holding on to those moderate voters. And so you've seen Buttigieg sort of tack
very
to the right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Hoping to pick up that vote and so forth. But it's still is an open question as to whether Democratic primary voters are going to be able to say, I need to be pragmatic. I need to pick somebody who can win. And that means winning more moderate voters than I myself am, because primary voters tend to be more extreme than general election voters on both sides.
Yeah, I'm suffering some PTSD flashback to 2015, where I spent the entire year telling Republicans, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this thing.
Yeah.
And now I feel like I'm saying this to the Democrats, don't do this thing, and maybe it'll turn out the same way. So I want to come back to Pete Buttigieg, because he, in fact, is doing something extraordinarily interesting. And, of course, we're going to get to the election results in Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and Virginia in just a moment. But this analysis of the persuadable voters is fascinating. They make up about 15% of the electorate. They're 57% male. They're 72% white. Only 35% of them have college degrees. Most of them, nearly 70%, usually vote for a mix. Among those who voted in the last presidential election, 48% voted Trump, 33% Clinton, 19% for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein.
And consider that. That's a huge number.
That's a big number. It's a very big number. So these are the potentially persuadable voters. They have different ideological takes, but they prefer, by a margin of 82% to 11%, a Democratic candidate who promises to find common ground over one who promises to fight for a progressive agenda. They prefer a moderate over a liberal by a margin of 75 to 19. So who are these persuadable voters? They kind of sound never Trumpy to me. 40% describe themselves as conservative, 16% are liberal, 40% are moderate. So then they look at the breakdown of what the how the persuadables lean right now. Trump leads Warren 49-27%, which is basically a little bit better than he did against Clinton. But he only holds a very narrow 43-37 edge over Biden, which, again, tells you the difference of what happens with these persuadable voters in these swing states, the difference between a Democratic Party headed by a moderate like Joe Biden or a increasingly flaming progressive like Elizabeth Warren.
Right. So this is in part a refutation of the argument you hear so often that there are no persuadable voters anymore, that it's everything in politics is a matter of driving out your base and inspiring your base, and that you don't need to think about persuadables. But look at the results of the 2018 midterms. I mean, in addition to the poll you were just citing, but the 2018 midterms showed Republicans losing in districts that had voted Republican forever. And they lost these persuadable voters. They lost the and many, by the way, are suburban voters. And that, you know, those small changes can make a big difference in the outcome of a race. And of course, as we know so well, in 2016, Donald Trump, this doesn't prove that it was persuadables, but we do know that it was very, very close. It's something like 77,000 votes over three states gave Trump the White House.
So let's go back to Pete Buttigieg, because you mentioned him. And the Washington Post had a very interesting piece the other day about this pivot toward the center. And here's something that that Buttigieg said over the weekend. He said, "The way we think this shapes up is if you want the most ideological far-out candidate possible, you've got your answer. You want the most Washington candidate possible, you've got your answer. Everybody else, I think, can come our way. I think that's almost everybody." So he's sharpened his criticisms against Warren on Medicare for All. He's gone after, you know, Sanders on the same sorts of things. He's running statewide ads in Iowa, arguing the proposals would take away choice for Americans. And he appears to be, you know, looking for that centrist lane, you know, between Warren and Biden. But also, I think it's very interesting. Dave Weigel sort of picked up on this, that in his updated stump speech, he talks about, the divided nation, the exhausted nation. And whenever he uses the term fight or fighting, he's basically saying, you know, we're tired of fighting. Fighting is not the point. The point is to get results. And it's a very subtle but very barbed contrast with Elizabeth Warren and the others who are, it's all about fighting. It's always about crushing your opponents. He mm-hmm. really is finding his own distinctive voice there, isn't he?
Yes. Buttigieg, right from the beginning, has had a moderate sort of affect as a person, as a politician. But when he first entered the race, substantively, he was pretty far to the left, and he was making some proposals that were anything but moderate, you know, packing the Supreme Court and a few other things. He has now sort of brought his stylistic moderation to bear on his substantive positions. And I think his mentioning this fighting point plays to one of his potential strengths. First of all, I think it's more than a little subtle dig at Elizabeth Warren. But second, if it's true that the voters tend to choose the person, the next president who's least like the one they just elected and the one they're eager to get rid of, and you can make that case going pretty far back in American history, Then Buttigieg is certainly the anti-Trump. He is highly educated. He served in the military. He is gay. He is he speaks seven languages. He's moderate in his style and highly articulate. So in all those ways, he could be seen as the anti-Trump. And now he's adding this other emphasis, which is, we're tired of the fighting. You know, that's what Trump is. That's what has been his strength. And he's saying, actually, you know, we need to present a more united image. He's even, in my judgment, gone overboard on this, saying it's the job of the president of the United States to unite the country. I'm not sure that's the job of the United States. It's nice when the president can every now and then unite the country.
At least say it,
but,
yeah.
But, or at least say it, yeah. But it's unrealistic to think that that's actually the president's job or it's achievable. But nevertheless, that I think is, and by the way, he's taking a little bit of a leaf from Obama's book there. Don't forget that Obama
became popular,
yes, by stressing that we are one America, not red, not blue, etc. That can be very powerful. We don't know if it will be enough in his case. I mean, we're in a brave new world. Of course, a short few years ago, it would have seemed inconceivable that the mayor of a small city, who I think won by 8,000 votes or something like that in his last election, would be a serious contender for the presidency. But we, of course, live in the era of Trump, who got zero votes before he was elected.
Well, this does seem to be moving, working for him, at least on the margins in Iowa, where he is moving up into the top tier. In fact, what I want to do is I want to play for you. I want to play for you one of these ads that he is running and listen to the way he talks about fighting. It's very aspirational. And let's just play it.
I am running to be the president who will pick up the pieces of our divided nation and lead us toward real action. We will fight when we must fight. But I will never allow us to get so wrapped up in the fighting that we start to think fighting is the point. The point is what lies on the other side of the fight. The hope of an American experience defined not by exclusion, but by belonging.
I'm Pete Buttigieg, and I approve this message.
You know what's really struck me watching that ad? First of all, how slick, how professional it is. He's got a lot of money. He's spending it well. But also, there was this moment I'm looking at him on the screen, which you can't see here because this is a podcast, where he's actually put on his coat and he kind of looks presidential. There's the moment there, and you get a different vibe from him. And I think, given especially this moment that we're in now, where people are suddenly realizing, you know, it's not the Twitter left that's going to decide the presidency. It is going to be centrist. And he seems to be aiming at that segment of the electorate. And the question, of course, as you pointed out, Mona, is whether or not that's going to play with the Democratic primary electorate. Okay, speaking of the electorate, let's talk about what happened last night in Kentucky and the various spins, including, I think, ladies and gentlemen, we have achieved peak Hugh Hewitt punditry in this. But let's do this right after a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only one in five homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wire Cutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. Okay, we are back with Mona Charon, our contributor and the host of the Beg to Differ podcast. Interesting night last night. Let's start with Kentucky, where Matt Bevin, the highly unpopular and toxic Republican governor, tried to wrap himself around President Trump, made the election a referendum on Trump, made the election a referendum on impeachment. The president, president came in and he rallied with him and he tweeted, you know, he said, you know, this is basically I'm on the ballot here. Matt Bevin goes down to defeat. But Republicans can also say they swept the rest of the ticket. So what does that say about Trump's coattails and the nationalization of the election?
Well, certainly the president is going to get his prediction validated, right? He said at that rally, don't let this happen to me because they will make a big deal out of this. And indeed, they will.
That's what he says. You got to vote because if you lose, it sends a really bad message. It just sends a bad and they're going to build it up. You can't let that happen to me.
To me. Right.
He's not wrong.
Nope, he's not wrong. And so, you know, look, to be fair, there have been times, there were some in 2018 where Trump's presence probably pulled people to victory. But this is an instance where it signally failed. And it's awkward because it was so tied to the impeachment issue. And this is Kentucky. This is a conservative
state.
Trump won
by 30 points.
Yes.
He won this state by 30 points. He goes all in and the governor loses.
Yeah, it was not a good night for the Republicans. And I live in Virginia, which for a while now has been called a purple state, but not anymore. It is now completely blue. It has the Democrats have taken command of the of both chambers, and they already had the governorship, weirdly occupied by somebody who appeared in blackface, Governor Northam. Wow. Not while he was governor, I quickly add. But
that story feels like we read it 10 years ago, and it was just a few months ago.
No, but, it's true. It's true. And it shows you my prognostication skills, because at the time I thought, oh, he can't survive this.
The only person who got that right was Jonathan Lass. But I mean, to put this into context, before Trump, Republicans controlled the House of Delegates by a margin of 66-34. Yes. They not only now have lost control, but it looks like the Democrats will have 55 or 56 seats out of 100, which gives them predominant control. So it has been a stunning turnaround for Virginia.
And for people who look at these collar counties, not just here, but all around the country, around Pittsburgh, around Philadelphia,
Cincinnati,
around Washington, D.C., Cincinnati, and so forth, the sort of the prototypical collar county here is Loudoun. This was the district that includes Virginia 10. It's where Barbara Comstock was the representative for many years, 30 years before she held the seat. It was held by Frank Wolf, a Republican. And Loudoun County voted Democrat, I think, by 63% this time.
Wow.
Which is astoundingly high. And don't hold me to that statistic. It was something in that neighborhood. It's very, very high. And you know, that is a bellwether, because Loudoun County sort of is typical of the counties that tend to determine elections.
Right. Well, and of course, the spins you're going to get will be people saying, well, Kentucky's still going to go, will still be red in 2020. Mitch McConnell will still be reelected, which is likely. Trump is still going to win. Virginia doesn't really change anything because he lost Virginia back in 2016. All true. But it is this pattern. And you look at what happened in Pennsylvania, which is not getting as much attention. Philadelphia Inquirer reporting the blue wave crashed down on Pennsylvania again as voters from Philly to Delaware County turned left. Also, suburbs of Cincinnati, and for people who are not familiar with the geography, yes, Cincinnati is in Ohio, but the suburbs are also in Kentucky, and they moved rather significantly toward the Democrats. So if you see this pattern of the erosion in suburban areas, is continuing and at least looks like it's accelerating, although we have to break down, break down the numbers at some point. So
the smarter, more sophisticated Trumpists will say, we knew this is the trade. We knew we were going to give up the suburban vote, especially women. But we're picking up the white blue collar and lesser educated vote and the rural vote. And they are really turning out. And so that's their case. And that still remains to be seen whether the president has the power to drive turnout among his dwindling base, because those, as well known, the number of white rural voters is declining, whereas the number of multi-ethnic suburban voters is increasing. And over time, it's very, very bad for the Republican Party, especially the Republican Party as it is currently constituted. But it's unclear just what that time frame is.
So I had invoked Hugh Hewitt's name before. He put out a tweet this morning. I'm going to read this verbatim. If people think they're misunderstanding it, you're not. Message from last night to Republican election professionals. Every GOP candidate on ticket statewide in a Trump state and almost everyone in a blue state has to put arms around POTUS and squeeze through 2020. MSM mainstream media, of course, missing this. Okay. Now I'm going to take a deep breath here because this is peak Hugh Hewitt. But the message from last night now is that every Republican needs to double down in their association with Donald Trump. Do not have any flashes of independence. Do not allow any distance between yourself. That watching what happened in Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Mississippi is a different story. His take is the Republicans need to double down on Trumpism.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The thing that happens when you have an extremely unpopular incumbent and leader of your party is that Republicans or Democrats, depending on who's who, are placed in an impossible situation because they cannot move too far away from their president without alienating his core supporters, who are also their supporters, but they cannot win independents by being and leaners by being too close to him. So they are in a no-win situation. And one of the things that Bob Costa, who's a very good reporter for the Washington Post, said on Twitter, I don't know if you saw it this morning, but he said that he had been talking with Republicans in the Senate. And who were watching the Kentucky race very closely because of its relevance to how they would vote on impeachment. And they, senators are facing a very, very similar kind of balancing act. They have to figure out whether to stick with the president or not. And the Hugh Hewitt interpretation will be in the ever Trump Hall of Fame, I guess.
Yeah, well, they do have a choice. I mean, not to be clown themselves. Laura Ingraham actually takes it one step beyond. Laura Ingraham is taking the Hugh Hewitt line. She's was on the air last night talking on the Kentucky elections. She said, that is the power of Donald Trump. This is all very good news for Republicans. Now, Tom Nichols, our friend Tom Nichols, who tweets under Radio Free Tom, tweeted out, this is, I think, for the win today. He says, I've been comparing these guys to North Koreans, but North Korean announcers don't make much and they have to do it or get shot. She does this for money on purpose.
Yeah, it's it's truly into the Orwellian era. You know, war is peace, right? I mean, it is just
let's go for the Orwellian defense, because you have a great piece up at the Bulwark today, which is your reply to this latest ever Trumper defense. The argument that we're starting to hear from actually pretty rational people are, you know, saying, okay, it's no harm, no foul. Donald Trump, yes, may have tried to coerce the Ukrainians into digging up dirt, but it nothing ever came of it. The aid was eventually released, so therefore there was no crime because there was no follow through. You're just not buying it, are you?
Right. This was the same argument that they made about the evidence of obstruction of justice in the Mueller report, itemized in the Mueller report. They said, you know, well, but his aides didn't carry out these crazy orders. They didn't fire Mueller and everything is fine. The guardrails are in place. And even if the president says unguarded or foolish things, it's OK. No harm, no foul. And, you know, I started off the piece by citing a news story from a couple days ago. A man in Colorado was arrested on a conspiracy charge to bomb a synagogue. He had just received two pipe bombs and some dynamite from some co-conspirators who turned out to be government agents. There never was a bombing of the synagogue. Nevertheless, this man is likely to spend the rest of his life in jail. Because he was a cheerful participant in this conspiracy and wanted to carry it out. So the idea that, you know, because the aid was, you know, so Congress got wind of what was going on with withholding aid from Ukraine and they began to make a stink. And so the aid was released. But that does not mean that the president was not misusing his authority in the most gangsterish fashion. And, you know, there's another thing, which is, this idea that, you know, they say, well, we caught it. It's okay. Mm-hmm. Look, there are so many examples of the president misusing his authority. He dangles pardons. He threatens people. He tampers with witnesses in public as well as in private. But it must be a tiny sliver of the amount of maladministration that is going on that we don't get wind of.
Especially because he makes no secret of his contempt for the rule of law and his belief that, in fact, he is exempt from many of the laws that apply to the rest of us.
He has had his lawyers go out in front of a judge and say that he's exempt.
Yeah. Now, this is literally the correct use of the word literally when he says he is literally exempt from investigation or arrest or being charged for crimes he commits while he is the president of the United States. So given that and given the pattern, this is where I think this is an important point. Now, of course, you might get the blowback. Well, you can't impeach somebody for stuff that has not actually been proven. On the other hand, you have a really ominous pattern. And like, I know this is way overused, but, you know, Al Capone didn't go down for all the crimes he committed. He went down for income tax evasion. You really do have this the mobster president who's been caught red-handed on this. You have to take this one seriously.
You know what? This is enough, right? If this were all we knew, we've become so unbelievably jaded because of this man's outrageousness. But if this were all we knew, it would be enough that he was willing and attempted to do an end run around Congress to illegally withhold aid that had been authorized by the Congress, signed by the president, and that he did it for the purpose of not for foreign policy purposes, but for his own political interests, strong-arming an ally like this, that's more than enough.
I don't think that we've gotten our full. I was reading about this morning and had the sense that there's still another element to this particular story that hasn't really been fully fleshed out, which was, why was Rudy Giuliani doing what he was doing? What were the business ties he had with the oligarchs? How did he end up with these sketchy characters? What is the real motivation? Is it just political? Is it just the desire to get Biden's? Or is there a more fundamentally corrupt motive here? I mean, what you're seeing is this morass of corruption surrounding President Trump and Rudy Giuliani and Rick Perry and all of these others. And what they're trying to do, of course, is to deflect from this by trying to make it about the Bidens and Hunter Biden, which we know how that sort of that gaslighting works. But I'm not sure that we've fully taken on board the old-fashioned, the potential for old-fashioned grift and graft that was going on there.
Well, yeah, couple things. First of all, one of the things that one can suspect, based on the president's conduct in other areas, like with his golf course in Scotland, you know, diverting the planes and so forth, you never know the degree to which this president may be acting out of his own personal pecuniary interests affecting U.S. government policy. But regarding the Ukraine story, you know, it does seem to me highly probable that there are mixed motives at work here, that Giuliani might have seen a money-making opportunity with the ability to leverage his authority with the president, his influence with the president, to somehow get some illicit relationships going with various Ukrainian officials and business people. And he may also have been aware that he could manipulate the president by playing into the president's belief in conspiracies. And so he apparently had a role in poisoning President Trump against Ukraine's government and against the current president by telling him all kinds of things about their role in the 2016 election. And so you could have all of these threads playing out, and sometimes they may intersect and sometimes perhaps not.
Okay, so you made my newsletter twice this morning, by the way.
Your
piece on the No Harm, No Foul made the deep thought section, but you also made the cheap shot section for this epic SmackDown tweet that you had. So Annie McCarthy, who is very well known in conservative circles and the National Review, tweeted out yesterday, "I've been like a broken record, but clearer now than ever," he wrote. "Only sensible defense here has always been assume there was a quid pro quo and argue that it's not consequential enough conduct to impeach over your daily reminder." And you pointed out, Andy, you wrote a whole book arguing for Obama's impeachment, which was, ooh. So here's a guy that argued that we should go after and impeach Barack Obama, arguing that even with everything we know and all of this testimony of the quid pro quo, that it's not enough. Boy, the goalposts have really moved, haven't they?
Yeah. Allow me to say, since one of the things that we try to do on Beg to Differ is to be civil with people we disagree with, that Andy McCarthy has never been anything but a gentleman in all of my interactions with him, including on this. He responded with lots of, you know, attempts to refute my point and said that I had misunderstood his book and whatever. But he was never nasty or cruel or any of that. And I appreciate that about him. So I just want to say, I think he's a gentleman. But we do not agree on this. I think that he is applying a very different standard now. He's looking for ways to exculpate Trump or defend him. Whereas, you know, when it came to Obama, he was ready to say, and I tweeted out some pictures from the book, which is on my shelf.
You had the receipts. You took pictures.
The receipts. You know, failure to one of the things that he would put in a bill of impeachment against Obama was, you know, with flouting the will of the Congress. Well, you know.
Oh, okay. But now arguing that that all of this is not enough. Now, as we began this conversation, actually, before we started the podcast, our colleague Jim Swift said, and remember, it was not just Obama. Andy McCarthy, who's now saying that this is not impeachable conduct, actually wrote a piece back in September 2016, before the 2016 election, arguing that Congress should impeach, wait for it, Hillary Clinton, to bar her from holding federal office. It's constitutionally right. Now when he said this, you're a witness to this. I said, no, that can't be true. Swift is making it up. So before we started the podcast, I went and I Googled it. And sure enough, there it is on the National Review page.
There it is.
But, you know, a month and a half before the election, for months, he wrote, "I have been arguing that Hillary Clinton should be impeached. It is all well and good to prosecute a former government official for any crime she has committed. Indeed, the Constitution expressly provides for criminal prosecution in addition to impeachment. Nevertheless, for the framers, The imperative was to deprive a corrupt person of any further opportunity to abuse government power. So really, the Donald Trump is like the first guy that Andy McCarthy doesn't want to impeach.
Yeah. I do in general, leaving Andy aside for now, but you know, I do in general wonder at the small, tiny number of people who are willing to be consistent in their standards. I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago saying, how many people do you know who favored the impeachment of Bill Clinton and favor the impeachment of Donald Trump?
I'm raising my hand.
Right,
here, so.
Right. Me too. I mean, to pat ourselves on the back. But there are, you know, it's just very, very, very hard for people to give up that drug of partisanship. And I'll tell you a personal story, because I've changed. Just as the country has become more and more partisan, I've become less and less. And I happen to have watched recently a documentary. It's old, but it was about Bill Clinton's presidency. It was called Clinton. It was by PBS. I think it was The American Experience. And as I was watching it, I was remembering the 1990s me. And the 1990s me really loathed Bill Clinton. Everything about him, just anything bad that happened to him was cause for rejoicing. It was bitter. It was nasty the way I felt toward him. And I thought I was justified at the time. And looking back now, I feel embarrassed about my partisanship. I mean, Bill Clinton is a very flawed guy, but he's not the devil. And the things that he did were not, they weren't evil. They were just really stupid. And
we've changed our standards rather dramatically. Look, I was on the air every day, you know, doing conservative talk radio. And so whatever you were doing, I was doing 3.5 hours a day, probably ratcheted up. And, you know, the fate of the Republic turned on whether or not he was getting, you know, blowjobs in the Oval Office. And this was the crisis of the Republic. Right.
The stain on the blue dress. Yeah, look, and for what it's worth, I still think we would be better off culturally and politically if he had resigned.
Oh, yeah.
I do, because it would have enforced the idea that you cannot just bluster and lie your way through things and get away with it. Well, but unfortunately, we learned the opposite lesson.
Well, and in part, I remember what the shock was, that we thought we were in a coherent moral universe where if in fact it turned out that the president of the United States was having sex with a 21-year-old intern, that would be it. Yeah. There was no question about it. And so I think the shock was the fact that the standards completely flipped, the guardrails were removed. He did perjure himself, and it was considered okay. That, I think, broke something in the American political culture, and it remains broken, and I think we're paying the price for that. I've argued before that you don't get Donald Trump without Bill Clinton, without the damage that was done there. But okay, so you're mentioning, you know, why there are so few people who have consistent standards. I actually have to go to Arkansas tomorrow and give a talk on political courage. So I've actually been looking up, various things. I'm rereading, believe it or not, rereading John F. Kennedy's book or Theodore
Ted Sorensen's book.
Ted Sorensen. I knew you were going to say that. and I'm finding it to be actually a little bit better than I had expected. And so let me just read you one of the things he says about it. He says, in whatever arena of life, one may meet the challenge of courage, whatever may be the sacrifices he faces if he follows his conscience. And then he lists those consequences: the loss of his friends, his fortune, his contentment, even the esteem of his fellow men. Each man must decide for himself the course he will follow. So he understood the dangers of, you know, breaking with the herd. Even, you know, political tribalism was not as intense, but at least he seemed to understand what political courage might lead to. So I guess the question is, why is political courage so vanishingly rare?
It used to be the case that every conservative that I knew and talked to for more than 15 minutes would say their favorite play was A Man for All Seasons.
Yes.
Right. Everyone loved that play, me included. And there's a scene where Thomas More, who, by the way, is the hero of the story, but there was a great series on PBS called Wolf Hall, in which he's the villain. So mm-hmm. I recommend that for people who want to see the other side. Very, very interesting. But in any case, in A Man for All Seasons, he is standing on conscience. He will not abide. He will not say that it's okay for the King of England to divorce his first wife, Catherine, and marry Anne Boleyn. And he won't buckle, and he winds up paying for it with his life. But there is a scene where he is talking to, I think, his son-in-law, who is urging him to just sign the damn paper. Mm-hmm. Everybody else has. Why don't you just do it? And he puts out his hands and he says, I hold my soul in my hands. He said, if I part my fingers, it will pour out. And each of us has to make that decision. You know, we hold it in our own hands. And I don't know that you have to be religious to believe that you have at a certain point there's an irreducible soul that each of us has that we have to keep as best we can honest. And very, very few people seem to be concerned about that. No, other things get in the way.
Well, maybe it's naive to be, you know, to be surprised by that. And by the way, I thought the quote you were going to cite was the one where he's standing trial and he sees that Richard yes. Rich has basically sold him out, and he has the
yes.
the necklace or whatever, the symbol of office of Wales, and he says yeah. it profits a man nothing to give his soul for the whole world but for Wales.
But for Wales, yeah, it's probably the most famous line from the whole play.
But it's worth remembering that among all of the bishops and all of the political figures of that time, everyone else basically went along with Henry VIII. That we're
yes.
talking about Thomas More because of his courage, but also because his courage was so rare. So there's nothing new, I suppose, about people going, yeah, I could be courageous, but then I would lose my job, or I would, you know, I would be
but
canceled.
But people would lose so little. I mean, you know, Moore gave up his head. Okay,
that's right.
Today you might lose some Twitter followers. You might lose a job. That does happen, and it has happened in the era of Trump. Not to people who are pro-Trump, but the opposite, at least in the conservative world. So you might lose your job. You might lose some speaking opportunities. You might lose some money. But compared with what people in repressive countries risk when they stand up for what they think is right, it's trivial. And yet so few people do it.
I also think, you know, that's an interesting point. Of course, I've never been a United States senator, which they say is a very heady experience. You know, they stop traffic when you cross the street and everything, and maybe you get addicted to that sort of thing. And, you know, I don't
know
whether you know, get first class air travel, or because, you know, everybody kisses up to you or something like that. I do wonder, in the conservative movement in general, though, leaving aside the elected officials, just the volume of people who are part of Conservative Inc., professional conservatives who make their living from the conservative or Republican infrastructure, which means that when that infrastructure decides it's going in a certain direction, then there's, you know, the price tag to be paid, the price to be paid for independence, you know, becomes your livelihood. And, you know, it's,
you know,
I'm always conscious of the fact that, okay, that I made some choices, but I was able to make them. You know, what if, you know, I had you know, kids in school and a mortgage and all of that, and I knew that if I said this about Trump, I'm done. I lose the job. I lose everything. Would I have been willing to do it the same? So I tried not to be totally judgmental about some of the people who have, because, you know, genuine courage actually, you know, does have really seriously negative consequences.
Right. No, I agree with that. And I try not to be too judgmental also, and that don't always succeed. But I would just say that one thing I think might have influenced me also is that my very first job in conservative world was at National Review right out of college. Bill Buckley hired me as editorial assistant, which was the job he would give to, you know, young up and coming types. And And I remember vividly that National Review, which I'd been reading since I was in high school, National Review was always saw itself and was seen as sort of the conscience of conservatism. So, you know, they would criticize Republicans who they felt were, you know, caving or not being conservative enough or not being principled enough. And that was a whole part of what it meant to be a conservative intellectual, was that, you know, your job was to say, here's the ideal, and we hope you will try your best to approach it, if not always achieve it. And but in our time, it's become so cult-like that there's absolutely no room for criticism of the cult leader, and it has become. And of course, you have social media now, and it's a very different world. But yeah. I guess was sort of I was trained in a world that where it was expected that you would buck the Republican Party for sure, and many elected officials.
Yeah, and that was the fun. Well, of course, in yesterday's podcast, I talked with Kevin Williamson, who, of course, is all out of bleeps to give as well. And you know, he was talking about how liberating it is, you know, not to be part of the cult, not to be part of the tribe. And I've certainly felt that way as well. But by the way, speaking of John F. Kennedy and profiles and courage, it is worth pointing out that when I look back on moments of real courage in the United States Senate, I think of Margaret Chase Smith standing on the floor of the Senate and denouncing Joseph McCarthy back in 1950. You'll recall that, mm-hmm. that moment. You remember John F. Kennedy had his chance to take a stand on the same issue, and he totally whiffed. In fact, in 1954, when the Senate finally got around to condemning Joseph McCarthy and vindicating Margaret Chase Smith's courageous stand, John F. Kennedy Jr. was the only Democrat not to vote in favor of it. He abstained from the vote. So a lot of people thought that Profiles
His brother was working for Roy Cohn.
Exactly. So a lot of people thought that maybe Profiles and Courage was his make good, that this was his way of like, okay, when push came to shove and I had a chance to do something courageous, I didn't, so I'll write this book instead. But that of course, is excessively cynical, isn't it? So, Mona Charon, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Charlie. Always great.
And we'll look forward to listening to the next episode of, and it is?
Beg to Differ.
Beg to Differ, which is posted every Friday, right, on the Bulwark Podcast?
Is that the most schedule? Most of the time, yes. Okay.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark episode, which was brought to you by SimpliSafe. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.